I think that any REIT that can simplify their story and help the generalist investor communicate that message to their investment committee wins the game when it comes to engagement and a proliferation of their story.
Hello and welcome to the REIT Report. I'm your host, Sarah Borkson-Quito. I'm pleased to be joined today by Gene Rubin, president of management consultancy firm Revel, to talk about strategic investor communications and investor engagement in the REIT space. Gene, welcome to the REIT Report.
Thank you.
So, Gene, Revel recently carried out a generalist reception study on the REIT industry. Can you walk us through what that process involved, Revel's expertise in this field, and some of the findings that came out of the study?
Well, the process is relatively simple. It is your basic customer satisfaction research. It's just that it's bent, if you will, to turn into an investor perception study. So it's when you're laying out of the goals of the questionnaire, of the survey, the idea was to figure out to what degree have investor perceptions evolved over the years as it pertains to REIT as an investment class? And are there any differences between the REIT dedicated investors and the generalists? We designed a questionnaire, created a sample, a couple of thousand potential investors, telephone interviewing, and then of course reporting. The whole process did take 3 or 4 months though. As far as our expertise, you know, we like to think of ourselves as the 800-pound gorilla in space, rightfully or wrongfully. We probably do Art Revel, right, the name of the company, invented the investor perception study 50 years ago. We probably do about 5,000 interviews a year with the investment community. We've conducted maybe 4,000 investor perception studies. So I've headed up 700 plus. So I think you get the idea. We work with 2/3 of the S&P. We really are deeply seated in, let's just say, the work of getting feedback from the investment community. So with that, though, I will turn to some of the things that we found. So first of all, outlook in North America specifically for REITs as an investment class definitely has improved. And it has improved significantly from 2018, which is the last time we actually did a similar survey. The place where you see it the most, and this is an interesting factoid to me, last time we did the study, over half of the investors said, we're underweight in the REIT class. This time, it's only about 40%. And it's a pretty big shift for when it comes for appeal in the space. With respect to what's driving investment appeal, it's the dividends, as you can imagine. Predictability. Investors talk about it being a hedge against inflation. Those are some of the top strengths. And by the way, whether it's a REIT investor or a generalist, they're on the same page with respect to what the, let's just say, the investment appeals are. The concerns, of course, are, as expected, interest rate sensitivity. And another one that's almost always, to some degree, dogging the space is slow growth. You do, by the way, interestingly, those who are REIT dedicated investors are a bit more sensitive, let's just say, to the volatility of the equity REITs when compared to private real estate investments. What else do we find? Industrial REITs, residential REITs, those lead the way when it comes to investment appeal, probably no surprise. But also, and perhaps surprisingly, maybe, generalist investors are very much up to speed on REITs as an investment. But what we have found in the research is that they may shy away because of the limited growth, because of forced distribution. And this is a little bit of tongue-in-cheek, but there is a lot of industry jargon that they have to get their arms around. And oftentimes re-explain the investment thesis with all that industry jargon wrapped around to their investment committee, which sometimes makes it just more difficult for them to do. A couple of other items, but earnings growth or FFO growth has really jumped as an investment driver from the last time. So last time to this time, that is the place I saw the biggest jump of what is driving investment and how important that particular investment driver is. Last thing is this, while reinvestment runs neck and neck with dividend growth, so for instance, how should capital be deployed? Reinvesting back in the business is running very close, again, neck and neck with dividend growth as the go-to capital deployment preferences. Investors generally prefer redevelopment and reinvestment into existing properties instead of new developments. There's not much appetite for stock buybacks right now in the space, perhaps because valuations are a bit richer. And there is very little love for M&A.
Yeah, that's a lot of information you got from that study. I'm just wondering what surprised you the most. Is it perhaps the focus on earnings growth that you said has really jumped as an investment driver?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that surprised me. But again, as a researcher, you take a look and you say, what jumps out? And that was a big jump. I think that the expectations for growth, or at least the need to see growth, are more pertinent today, or at least more relevant than they were 5 years ago, as investors considered REIT as an investment. They're looking for growth. I'll say that what, if anything, surprised me was the anticipation I had going into this was that generalist investors were going to come across as less knowledgeable, or at least only understanding this space on a topical level. In fact, what we found is that generalist investors typically have a dedicated real estate person that is highly knowledgeable, much like a REIT-dedicated investment house is. It's just that they then have to re-explain the story to those at their generalist firm, or at least the generalist fund, who are not well-versed in REIT as an investment class. And it's critical to make it easy for them to do so.
Yeah, that was going to be my follow-up question about the generalist investor. I mean, that's an encouraging sign to know that this knowledge is kind of permeating out there.
It is. And I'll tell you, as always with research, what happens is you do the research, you review the results, and then you ask yourself questions and you try to rationalize. And, you know, I attended the Nareit conference where one of the big messages during one of the breakouts was the degree to which the asset class has grown from, I don't know, tens of billions of market cap to leave over trillion, some kind of a massive amount of a market cap. So clearly, you know, that's going to bring along generalist investors who are bringing their pocketbooks with a bigger pool of money. The question always was, well, are they coming as onlookers on the periphery, or are they actually rolling up their sleeves and getting to know the business? And clearly, the fact that it's become a much more powerful investment class in size, in scope, and in investability, you're going to have professionals at the generalist firm say, look, we need somebody who understands the space and then can translate it to us as an overall investment committee. So we're definitely seeing that.
Interesting. And Gene, how would you compare the findings from the REIT study with what you're seeing in other industries? Are the concerns the same?
My question is going to be yes and no. So of course, there's always the same concerns. There's always macro issues that investors are concerned about. Investors are always looking for the same thing, right? Risk-adjusted returns. But there are some things that are specifically similar. So for instance, management credibility. I call them the three C's. Management credibility, cash flow, and capital deployment. So those three are similar in that is top number one, number two, and number three most important investment drivers as investors are thinking about making an investment, whether it's in a typical equity or whether it's a REIT investment. Again, management credibility, the reliability of cash flow or the cash flow strength, and how management is deploying capital. But what's different, I find, is the importance of balance sheet. But it seemed like investors, whether they are REIT dedicated or generalist, probably even more so generalist, are sensitive to that balance sheet because right, typically, I don't know if it's a rule of thumb or not, but buy side looks at companies, they're looking at three times perhaps debt to equity as something that is palatable. And if it's more than that, the generalist gets very uncomfortable, very antsy, and always looks for answers. So whenever they take a look at balance sheets that are, I don't want to say stressed, but are heavier than what's normal for typical investment, they begin to ask questions. Of course, the dividend, right? The dividend is ubiquitous, and this is why they're here. It's also the importance of the dividend is different when it comes to the REIT as opposed to your regular, if you will, equity investment. And then for me, the big one is ESG. So we've all heard it a million times at every conference, at every meeting, every consultant, everywhere you pick up the paper, it's ESG all over the place. Now, of course, you've got anti-ESG people, but the bottom line is the prevalence and the importance of ESG to the REIT investment, especially amongst REIT investors, jumps out as a significant difference compared to the generalists as they think about your traditional equity or regular equity as opposed to REITs, and also when they're taking a look at REIT investments. But it makes sense because you've got the natural born environmental component of any type of reinvestment, if you will, into real estate or properties. And then, of course, that investors oftentimes that invest in space come from pension funds. So for them, ESG is, let's just say, something that is more top of mind. Last, well, a point on ESG. REIT investors all looked at RASB. generalists wouldn't even know how to spell it, because for generalist investors, it is MSCI, it is Sustainalytics, it is Bloomberg, to a lesser degree, ISS. GRASB simply does not roll off their lips. They have no interaction with it, virtually none. Whereas for the REIT dedicated investors, it is in fact GRASB where they go to first and foremost, before then spilling over into MSCI, Sustainalytics, Bloomberg, or ISS.
So definitely a bit of a divide there.
Without a doubt.
And I wanted to ask you about, you know, given the investment climate we're in today, do you think REITs are having to work harder to get their message out? And have they had to sort of change the message in any way?
The investment environment at any point is always rather unique. So what makes now unique? You know, we've had a decade of where investors have chased the no-lose, if you will, growth in tech for a decade. Throw a dart at a wall, you're making money. And then they've been forced to slam on the brakes over the last couple of years because of well-covered tech wreck. They pulled back on risks and they really began to look for what? Stronger balance sheets, profitability, reliability, stronger cash flows. And obviously there have been some REIT categories we all know who have suffered as well. The overall space has become actually more appealing. And the ESG tidal wave, I think, has helped because, again, REIT ESG stories not only check the green box for those who say, I need to check the box on ESG, but also provide a secular growth opportunity via reinvestment into greener builds and buildouts. So I think that's one of the reasons why there is more appeal, not only among REIT investors, but also generalists of the space. Now, as the markets begin to recover and as the tech ultimately is going to come back into play, I think that this is a window, if you will, for REITs to hone their story and capture the attention of the investors that for a decade perhaps have been overlooking the space and figuring out a way to connect the things that investors have begun to really appreciate about growth opportunities from tech and at the same time wrap it with some of the consistency and some of the reliability that is brought to the table with the REIT investment. I do think if we focus on making sure we make it simple, because we've gone from what? The ability to tell a story for 6 hours during an investor day to after COVID, no more than 2 hours. So you need to simplify your story always, but now you have a larger audience for the story. As they begin to gravitate perhaps back towards the tech investments, et cetera, we want to make sure that we hang on to their interest. And how do you hold on to their interest? You remember to remind them about risk-adjusted returns as opposed to chasing the rainbow with tech. I think any REIT that can simplify their story and help the generalist investor communicate that message to their investment committee wins the game when it comes to engagement and a proliferation of their story.
Yeah, interesting. That's probably hard for some companies to do, just to sort of keep it simple. Often it's you sort of want to go in the other direction, but...
Well, you know what happens... Again, and I speak in generalities, that's the fault typically of a consultant, but you know, where do all the questions come from? Wait, whenever the question comes from the sell side is typically highly focused on space and already is looking for line item questions. So they'll typically force a management team into a question that gets management and IR, investor relations, to focus on, let's just say, the tactics, the minutiae, the detail, whereas a lot of the questions that go unasked are from the investors who oftentimes are less likely to be looking at the nitty gritty and are more likely to understand end market drivers. Why company? Why industry? Why now? As opposed to a specific line item. And I think it's important for management and IR always to keep in mind that when they're answering questions, while it's the sell side asking, it's oftentimes the buy side that's listening.
What about global investors? Is there a whole different strategy that companies need to adopt in order to attract that cohort?
You know, in some ways, I think that REITs have a leg up. UK investors, for instance, love dividends. Capital deployment, when it comes to dividends, it is the UK investor base that is most likely to appreciate a dividend above US, North America, above even continental Europe. And in continental Europe, they have wrapped themselves around, again, this is well known, wrap themselves around the ESG pole, and they've done so for a long time. But what it has changed is this. Buy-side corporate access has come on to the playing field very quickly. So what we've had for a long time is sell-side corporate access as the only game in town. Perhaps you can hire a consultant to help you get some meetings. Typically, company engages with their sell-side analyst and says, I need meetings with investors. Well, as the economics for the sell-side continue to be challenged, it is the buy-side now that is actually building corporate access teams. Corporate access teams, they're there basically as the investor relations function of the firms that welcome public company outreach and then help public companies figure out who they're supposed to communicate within the fund. Well, as companies continue to engage globally, have to be aware of how buy-side corporate access can help. It may very well be the way to go. And last thing I will say is that buy-side corporate access teams are actually very friendly with one another. They're not highly competitive. So what they'll do oftentimes is if a company wants to engage with a potential investor globally, they can contact the buy-side access team, corporate access team, and simply ask them, hey, who are the other buy-side corporate access teams in the area that you better connect with? And more often than not, they'll give you the contact. So I don't know if that is a unique enough tactic, but what I am seeing is that engaging with investors, yes, virtual, yes, digital, but it is the buy-side corporate access team increasingly that's becoming, in my opinion, that helps company separate the wheat from the chaff.
Gene, is there a way to measure the success of investor engagement efforts, like the steps that you've mentioned already? And are there clear signs when an approach is or is not working?
Look, you know, I've made my living here at Revel doing investor perception research. I've probably managed 750 of them in my 23 years. It is a lot. And it's for me to get around this question without saying that perception research is probably one of the best ways to measure the effect. Well, because you have a message. We are ABC. To what degree is the investment community here ABC? Then, do you value ABC? Well, we want to measure to what degree the investment community values our A message, B message, C message. And if you hear ABC and you like ABC, then theoretically, the alignment is there. Now, all I have to do as a company is deliver on ABC, and it's a match made in heaven. So is there a way to measure? It really is, to what degree does the investment community hear the message and value the message? And if we can measure that, then theoretically, the function, the effort works. Now, the last thing would be is growing the tent, meaning today I have 50 people that follow the company. I'd like to increase it to 100 people that are following the company. And of course, I'd like them to be quality and appropriate. Well, how do you test that? Well, there's a subjective way to do it. I'm getting invited to more conferences. I've got more sales site coverage, but you don't always control that. What you can control is the degree to which you are expanding the audience by direct interaction and building out your relationships. So another way to use, and again, I apologize if it sounds like a pitch for a perception study, but let's say today you do a study and you get a list of 200 people that are following perhaps the company. And with all hands on deck, you're able to conduct 32 interviews. And that's the maximum. Then what you do is you spend the next 2 years vigorously engaging, proactively engaging with current and potential investors. If nothing else, you do another project, you will find out that, for instance, this time you're able to get 52 interviews. My point is, you've grown the tent of people paying attention, whether they like the message, don't dislike the message, agree, disagree, whether or not they think management's credible or not. What you've done is grown the tent. So in my opinion, those are two ways. I can give you a long list of other ways. I'm going to give you one more that's not a perception study. Let's say your shareholder base doesn't change over time, over the course of a year. At the beginning of the year, you ask your top 10 or 15 investors, what do you mean concerns? Biggest questions. And they come back to you with 3 or 4 questions. At the end of the year, ask that same audience, what are your biggest questions? If they no longer ask you those questions, then theoretically, you've done a good job answering them. So those are just some of the ways.
So just a quick question. How often should you be doing this, you know, perception studies and sort of follow-up questions?
There is no perfect answer to that. I would say the best way to think about it, a perception study, is the way you think about getting a physical done at the doctor's office. How frequently should you do it? You should do it regularly. Do you need to do it every single year? Probably don't have to. Is it the right thing to do? Probably yes. I'll tell you what you shouldn't do. You shouldn't get a physical done after having a late night party because it's not going to give you an accurate reading. So you shouldn't be right during a perception study after something hot, such as we just made an announcement about an acquisition. Oh, we just changed management, or we just had some kind of a horrible earnings release or a fantastic earnings release. Other than that, something systematic. Most companies do them every year or two.
Great. And I wanted to combine two questions, really. Looking at the rise of Gen Z investors, what efforts are being made to educate and attract this group, and also how you see investor engagement efforts evolving. I mean, I imagine that they will have to evolve to attract this new younger cohort of investors.
Yeah, I mean, look, at the risk of sounding coy, what is it about Gen Zers? It's AI. This is going to be the future one way or another. I don't know how. Certainly, they multitask. So there's going to be times when a management team or perhaps an investor relations function are going to be communicating with somebody, and they're going to think that they're not paying attention because they're doing seven other tasks. The reality is they're probably actually absorbing everything that you're saying. And companies need to be able to get comfortable with the fact that a Gen Zer can be sipping a latte, uploading a picture of themselves on an Instagram post, actually listening to what you're saying while also reading the news on another company release. But I think more seriously, the retail investor may be making a comeback. They have more muscle. They help companies fend off activists. They are the anti-passives. That's right. We know that passive investment investors have been growing in stature. Well, we can't really convince passive investors to listen to our story or our strategy. They're really all about, right, governance and sustainability and ESG. Well, the retail investor is increasingly flexing their muscle, and they are actually paying attention to a story. Now, direct engagement with them is not really going to be their thing because they're not about direct. Look, take a look at a Gen Zer. Are they about direct engagement? Probably not. So companies are probably going to have to embrace things like social listening and social speaking strategies, engaging with this audience, understanding where they are mentally about a story through social media, and perhaps even communicating with them through social media. And now I don't mean TikTok, obviously. How much effort is being made to educate and attract this group? I think we're already here. I think ESG and all the effort, emphasis, communications, structure, that has been the Gen Z message. As Gen Zers grow up and mature, ESG fever will subside, but company brands as investments will have taken strong roots in their minds at a younger age. And all of those roots are going to be based in their perceptions on how they are on E and on the S. So I think that the ESG message actually is the Gen Z message. So that 10 years from now, when the Gen Zer perhaps is less focused on ESG as they're thinking about their kids, their home, etc., the brand of a company is going to be etched in their mind, and it was formed via its ESG messaging.
We've covered lots of interesting ground today, but any final thoughts you want to share to wrap up this discussion?
I'll tell you, my last thought was just an observation. I went to the NAREIT conference in New York, and I was encouraged by how many investors were there, present in mind and body, and how eager they were to ask questions and engage with management. I think that the space is one that is not only attractive, but one that will continue to attract new investors and generalists for years to come. That conference was great. Those are my two thoughts about it.
Yeah. All right, Gene. Well, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you today, and hopefully we can do this again.
Absolutely. If you have me back, I'll be more than happy.
And to our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode of The REIT Report, please subscribe or leave a review on your favorite podcast platform.